Okay, as you can see from the title slide, here on the 1st of May, we've got now our 16th class. I'm anticipating that we'll have a total of 18 on this grand book of Leviticus. However, we're into a section where the chapters do not lend themselves very comfortably for, you know, saying tonight we're going to do chapter 24 and 25. A couple of chapters, these last few that are coming up, are unusually long. So likely we'll be just going as far as we can this evening, picking up next week. I think we'll certainly get through chapter 24 and then into chapter 25, and not totally sure exactly where we'll wind up. Tonight I've chosen, since we have already spent so much time on the tabernacle in much earlier classes, so I chose not to bring any more of those artist illustrations. We're going to be talking about the lampstand and the table of showbread today, but only very briefly. We've really contemplated that material previously. And so we'll kind of charge on through chapter 24, as beginning at least, rather rapidly, and then see where we get to 25. So with that said, there will not be any chart but this one this evening, very similar to last week. I'm just going to put up the verse references. If you'd like in your Bible then to take those verse references and do some sort of marking in your Bible, just identify the material. For instance, chapter 24's first four verses are about the golden lampstand. So you can draw your little parenthetical symbol there. And those four verses read like this. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the sons of Israel that they bring to you clear oil from beaten olives for the light, to make a lamp burn continually outside the veil of testimony in the tent of meeting," so in what we would call the holy place, but not the holy of holies. "Aaron shall keep it in order from evening to morning before the Lord continually. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. He shall keep the lamps in order on the pure lampstand before the Lord continually." Now, in my Bible, we've got that typical seven-branched candle holder, you know, lampstand. It's so hard to get away from candles. They weren't candles. It is translated candlesticks, I think, in the King James, but it's a lampstand. And we've just been told clear beaten olive oil for that light. So they'd have to be tending to that, refilling those lamps, of course, and keeping that light burning. You then ask, well, what is this for? What does it represent? Why are there seven branches in order? I think that I would say, I don't know, I don't know, and I don't know. There's not a lot of information that's been added to this, though a tremendous amount of speculation has been added. Jesus spoke about the light of the world. We can think about, you know, the gold. We can think about the number seven. We can think about the oil. We can see all kinds of references to these things in other places that aren't directly tied to the lampstand at all. And so tonight I'm just not prepared to even comment on it. God wanted this thing to be done. There is a light that is to be continually burning. It's in a certain location, you know, very specifically attended by Aaron. And they did this for the 1,500 years of the law. So, any comment or question about the lampstand? I showed you all the artist illustrations before, how it was placed. Okay, they didn't think so, and so we'll just say run on into verse 5 through 9. In verses 5 through 9, you now have what is called the table of showbread. There is to be these certain loaves, you know, with a particular recipe for them, that is also kept in the same area on the other side of that holy place. So verses 5 through 9 read like this. "Then you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2 tenths, they've added, of an ephah." You can find from other places, I believe, but that's a measurement that, again, I'm not particularly familiar with. "But 2 tenths of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them in 2 rows, 6 to a row, on the pure table," which again was a gold table, we learn in other places, so they've inserted the word gold in my text in italics, but it was gold, "a table before Yahweh. And you shall put pure frankincense," so one particular form of incense, on each row, that it may be a memorial portion for the bread, an offering by fire to the Lord. Every Sabbath day he shall set it in order before Yahweh. Continually, it is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons. They shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him from Yahweh's offerings by fire, his portion forever. Once again, I don't have a lot of information I can add to that. They were ordered to do it. They did it because God asked them to do it. And then what this might represent and how, you know, it might bear on the Lord's Supper or something like that, there have been endless amounts of speculation. Again, I don't have any direct ties to such ideas. So again, I think we'll just leave it there. This was all a part of those functions that we saw in those earlier lessons. So with that, does anybody have any comment or question about those two things? As you can see, I'm a little surprised they're even here at this location. Seems like it just would have been back at the other. For some reason, God wanted Moses on a separate occasion to set this before those priests. Was there a problem that had arisen? They weren't, you know, quite doing it properly or something. I don't know. But we've touched on all that before. So any comment or question on the golden lampstand or the table of showbread? Okay, again, didn't think so. So that now, though, is going to open up a whole world for us of related materials, not related to that, but new subject, in chapter 24, first, with a case, with a physical event that took place, and now what are we going to do about it? So chapter 24, verses 10 through 16, we have an event where an individual has sinned. What now should we do about it? As you're well aware, this book of Leviticus is being ordained and then recorded, is being revealed to Moses, spoken and recorded about 1 year after they had gone into the wilderness. The tabernacle has been entirely created and set up and is now fully functioning. But one of the responsibilities, as we've seen, of those priests was to be judges, to function as a sort of a court of law. So here in verse 10, the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian. So already, unusual circumstance. She had been married while in slavery. She has an Egyptian husband. Went out from among the sons of Israel, and the Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel struggled with each other in the camp. So they got into some kind of fight. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name Yahweh and cursed. So they brought him to Moses. Now his mother's name was Shelemeth, the daughter of Dibri of the tribe of Dan. So there's an emphasis there that this is not just a hypothetical. It was an actual event. Here's the name of the woman. Now, just for a moment, though, kind of put yourself back in the circumstances. How do you feel about this? Would it be easier or harder for a young man who has an Israelite mother but an Egyptian father to have little respect for Yahweh? Well, of course, it's going to be easier for him. He's going to have had influences all of his life, and through the Egyptian, likely, that were not respectful to the God of heaven. The Egyptian father comes out of a culture that had no respect for Yahweh. We are not told if he converted. We're not told if he's even living. We're not told if he came out into the wilderness with his wife. We don't know how long the Egyptian father had influence over the son. We only know this is what transpired. So we have a boy who has mixed breeding and therefore mixed messages, you know, spiritually. He curses Yahweh in the midst of a fight. Well, that's about as common as anything can be. People lose control, they get angry, they say all kinds of things, and he's having a fight. Is he likely having his fight with another Egyptian? Well, hardly. There weren't a whole lot of Egyptians that came with him out here into the wilderness. And so, apparently, again, reading between the lines, but he's likely having the fight with an Israelite. And so you can kind of see it. We also don't know what the fight was over, but it might have been over this very thing. It could have been that he was just a crass, profane, blasphemous kind of a guy using the Lord's name as a curse or cursing God himself. And the way he's behaving then would easily offend other Israelites. Certainly the very fact that he is half Egyptian would be something of an offense. How many grudges would people be still carrying a year into the escape from Egypt after they'd spent their entire lives being abused as slaves? You know, make the same quote of bricks, you can't have a straw anymore either, go get that too. You know, it was tough, it was terrible, it was bad. So it's easy to see how a conflict like this would arise and how his mindset would lead him to do this. Now, what are we supposed to do? And bear in mind, it's not a real cut and dried case either. If it was two Israelites, then would it be easier or harder for people to know what we ought to do here? Would have been a lot easier. But what are we supposed to do when it's half and half? And what are we supposed to do with these sojourners we'll be hearing about later that and have already been hearing about, you know, that come to live with us? And they're not Jews, but they're still living with us. They're traveling with us. They're the sojourners that have joined us. You know, how do our laws apply to them? That's why you have noticed already, and you'll be seeing it again, that repeatedly God will say, this is the law, and then he'll add something like, for the Jews and for the sojourner among you. No distinction between the two. Well, here's our test case. What are we to do? And in verse 12, they put him in custody so that the command of Yahweh might be made clear to them. Then Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, bring the one who has cursed outside the camp. Let all who heard him lay their hands on his head. Then let all the congregation stone him. You shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if anyone curses his God, then he shall bear his sin. Moreover, the one who blasphemes the name of Yahweh shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him, the alien as well as the native. So now we're thinking in terms of the Gentile as well as the Jew, but all living together and traveling in the wilderness. Not a lot of those aliens, but there'll be more as time goes by. We got some now. When he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death. That's what's to be done. So I'm presuming that that's what they did. But we have a case where he has blasphemed God's name is one expression that's used, and then he has cursed God is the other expression that he's used. What is God's judgment? Capital offense. He's to be put to death. But look at how personal this is. Now, USA Today, somebody forwarded it to me from Georgia, as a matter of fact. USA Today, just 2 days ago, I think it was, had a big article. And it was another one of these titles, something like, Let's Face It. And then it was one of the most blasphemous articles I've ever read. And so the guy was just saying, the Bible is wrong, and it's about time we accepted it. The things that the Bible says about homosexuality, the things that the Bible says about this, that, another thing, you know, he coughed up a couple of these, three it was, these examples of how the Bible's self-contradictory and or cruel by his statements. But if ever there was a blasphemer, the guy that wrote the article, you know, was one of them. And it, but it was a particularly atrocious, particularly vicious, particularly, just rebellious. And the way he passed this arrogant judgment on all of the Bible is just accept it. It's wrong. It's full of errors and mistakes. And it's just time that all of us who call ourselves Christians just abandon belief, you know, in these scriptures, because, you know, it's just wrong. Wrong, 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 and on and on. And on you went. Well, it's not. But this would certainly be one of those places where people in our culture today get more than a little bit upset. So those, you know, in positions of power have been working, you know, throughout all our lifetimes and before to do away with capital punishment. They've tried to equate a capital offense with murder. They've tried to say that even after, you know, you had a duly processed court of law render a verdict, that if that verdict is, you know, that the death penalty should be instituted, well, then you're no different than he is at all. It's all same, same. You know, you're just taking a life, it makes you a murderer too. Well, to say they're ignorant, you know, scripture is the understatement of the century. You know, they're not equatable at all. And the things God says about the end of the death penalty indicates that we're going to have more and more and more of the worst and worst kinds of sins that are going to be promoted and perpetrated because you're taking away the ordained divine punishment. Capital punishment is taught in both the Old Testament and the New. And the list of death penalty offenses I handed out or had handed out when you came in this evening. So if you don't have one of those sheets, raise your hand and there's one at the very back there. Ron, could I ask? I don't see Dean, but he's probably right behind those doors. If he hopefully will have another one of those, and so everybody can have one. But, you know, take that on home. Oddly enough, and I spent a lot of time creating this chart by going online, finding lists, and then looking at, you know, my own scriptures here. But it's really rather difficult to number the capital offenses in the Old Testament. And so on the list that I created here, I did some combining and my own thoughts about how they ought to be listed. And as you can see, I've come up with 30. I left two blank lines so that Lee can bring me the other if I missed, like she did last time. These are always a work in progress, and truly I appreciate that. You know, I carry these forward. And so if you find another one you think I've missed, you know, please let me know. But I did some combining. You know, some of these lists will say, for instance, if you'll look down at number 10. Number 10 says, encouraging service or worship of other gods. Well, in the scriptures there, they were actually listed separately. Anybody who promotes the service of a foreign god, and in another place, anybody who promotes the worship of a foreign god, I could see a distinction between those two, you know, then was to be put to death. And the entirety, line number 10, of Deuteronomy chapter 13 is on that subject. There's actually three different kinds of people there that could be guilty of this. All three of them, if they encourage either the service or the worship of another god, are to be put to death. So, you know, you could call out one line like I did, or you could have put it on two lines, or you could have put it on six lines, you know, because you got three different examples. One is, you know, a prophet, and then you have just any individual, and then you have a city that would do it. So, you know, but it's the same offense and the same two offenses. So I came out with a total of 30. Shortest list I saw was 28. Longest list I saw was 36. This is stunning to most people because in our culture, what offenses would carry a death penalty? Name one.
Murder.
Name a second one. See, that's right. In our culture, that's how bad it's become. In most cases, murder is the only thing people can come up with. That's just where they run out of gas. Because in our culture now, we've abandoned God's standard of punishment, but more importantly, we've abandoned God's standard of identifying what is sin and what the proper penalties for sin should be. So I'm just going to read these out for the sake of those that might be listening to the tape, and they may not have, you know, the copy here. But number one is murder. That's in the column for prohibition. And you'll see I've given you several references, not exhaustive, but, you know, representative list of where you have the passage that assigns the death penalty to that particular crime. Number two is breaking the Sabbath. Now, of course, the Seventh-day Adventist Church teaches today that you have to keep the Sabbath, that God is going to be very displeased with you if you don't, but they've long ago abandoned the penalty. So they want you to believe that you're still beholden to keep that law, but they've taken away the penalty. And so, you know, you really can't do that. If you're going to teach that you have to have the one, well, then you need to have the other too. Now, next comes number three is kidnapping. Certainly that is worthy of the death penalty if you're asking me. And you're asking me, you know, to tell you what God said about it. So in this case, it can't be wrong. Kidnapping is a punishable by death. Now, number four was another one of these that you could list separately. So I wound up with et cetera. But there's quite a range of sorcery and witchcraft and mediums and spiritists, you know, and all these different words that are used. You've got astrologers that would go in there. You had guys that made potions that were in there. You know, there's a bunch of stuff. I just went with two, sorcery and witchcraft, you know, et cetera. But those things carry the death penalty. Your friendly neighborhood palm reader under Moses' law of the time would be put to death. And we've just had the case, you know, to show. We're going to be impartial even if the individual is not a full-blooded pedigreed Jew. He's going to have to be put to death if he's going to live among us and be blaspheming the name of God. This number five and six and seven, you know, drives our culture mad. They've essentially, so many of them, abandon all kind of discipline for their children, and that's why our culture is falling into so much violence and sin. But if you strike a parent, you curse your parent, or you rebel against your parent, you just won't take their advice, these three carry a death penalty. Number eight is serving or worshiping false gods. Number nine is idolatry. Number 10 is encouraging service or worship of other gods. So might have put those two together, I guess. But 8 and 10 are the difference between the practice or the promotion. They both carry the death penalty. In 11, sacrificing to other gods. Number 12 is blaspheming the name of God. And that's the case that we just read and started our discussion in Leviticus 24. Now, let's come back to that one then for just a minute. If these Jews are to obey both the law and the prescribed form of punishment, you hear somebody blaspheme God's name. They curse Jehovah. And you hear it every day. For most of you, I'd be very surprised if you don't hear it every day. Some form of taking the Lord's name in vain, or cursing even himself or in his name. You know, we see that and hear the full gamut essentially every single day. It's hard to get away, you know, from it. Now, you hear somebody do that. You're a Jew. What's your responsibility? Take it to the priests. Priests are going to render a judgment. If we have two or more witnesses, then, we read it, tell me what now we're going to do. We're going to have an assembly where?
Outside
the camp. We're going to have the whole of Israel go outside the camp. And then, everybody that heard this man do this, what are they going to do? They're going to gather around the man, and they're going to lay their hands on his head. How personal does that get? Try to imagine yourself in this position. Today, you know, it's the hardest thing in the world to witness an execution. First, because they're so rare. And secondly, because, you know, our system has got it set up. Nobody sees it. It's considered somehow obscene, you know, and all the rest of that. Who was going to see this death penalty take place? Everybody in Israel. Who was going to actually make physical contact? And when you do that, who's to do that? The one that heard them. So who are these people? They're the witnesses who are testifying. And you're going to put your hand on his head. And when you do, you are saying, I condemn you to death in the name of the Lord because I witnessed you blaspheme his name. What kind of courage does that take? This is why, of course, the great failure happens. So many people just lack the courage. They won't stand up and defend what the truth is. They're always trying to make nice, you know, and trying to teach us that that's what matters above all things. But this death penalty thing, it was not an obscenity to be hidden. It was something to be done precisely so you, deep as you possibly can, impress everybody that that, what? That ought not to be done. And you know why, because you've seen what the consequences actually are. So there we are. Number 12 is blaspheming the name of God carries a death penalty. 13, rebelling against Joshua, I did not find on anybody else's lists, but I put that one in there. And then in parenthesis, I put appointed ruler. Maybe I did find it on one list now I think about it. But in Joshua 1:18, specifically God says, you know, pay attention to you, Joshua, they're going to be put to death. And then again in 2 Samuel, many years later, you're going to also have in chapter 20, verses 1 through 22, you know, a discussion about somebody who just won't do what the ruler says to do, put him to death. And the same goes in verse 14 for the priest or the judge. So you do have a distinction, if you will, between the quote-unquote secular government in number 13, you know, your civil government, which is Joshua, as opposed to a priest or a judge. Joshua wasn't either one of those. But if you just disobey the judgment, you're to be put to death too. 15, sacrificing a child to an idol. Now I put in parenthesis Molech. I didn't read my whole Bible here, but in preparation trying to put this together, I think what I'm seeing is that Molech is the only god who's named with regard to child sacrifice. Okay? Now, South America was Incas, Aztecs, you know, whoever it was. You know, we understand, practice that, you know, hear about that all the time. But sacrificing, you know, a child carries the death penalty. 16 is leaving a city of refuge after you've committed manslaughter. Does not have to be murder. In fact, it isn't murder. It's an accident. But even in an accident, God felt that respect for human life was to be so high that even if it's an accident, then what is the blood avenger? The avenger of blood, who's that? If an accident takes place and somebody dies, a close family member is permitted to put the person to death who accidentally took that life. Unless that person can do what? Flee to a city of refuge where they have to live out their days. Now, if they get to the city of refuge, that's all well and good. But if they leave the city of refuge, then what? They can be put to death. Okay, Bill?
I believe they only had to stay there as long as the high priest lived.
Yeah, I think Bill's right too. And so much of the time it'd be a life sentence. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that upon the death of the high priest, there is a forgiveness there. Okay, thank you for pointing that out. I think you are right on that one. Okay, so if you leave that city of refuge, that's just the deal. And so we say, that's not fair. That's unjust. I'm going to write an article, you know, for USA Today. Well, you know, I'm sorry that your sense of justice is so mistaken. It's a real tragedy that your heart is so hard that you can't appreciate this justice. But this is God's declaration. And if you don't like it, it's not time to write an article about how wrong the Bible is. It's about time to do some soul searching about how wrong you are. Now in 17, adultery, and it is specific in this case, though not always as we saw when it comes to sexual sins. In this case, both male and female adulterers/adulteresses are called out individually. For some of these other sex crimes, of course, only the male was actually stated in the scripture. Female, we're deducing and extrapolating, but you know, not always both. With adultery, it is both. Adultery carries a death penalty. What does it carry in America today? A high Nielsen rating. That's the difference in our culture. So in our culture, you want to have a whole show about adultery, you know, do it week by week by week, you'll be celebrated and receive awards. You would be put to death for practicing that pretty short season in those days. Sex with your father's wife, we read about in 1 Corinthians 5. Sex with your son's wife. Homosexual intercourse. Now, in the Old Testament, it's not as specific as in the New, but we're dealing with the Old Testament right here, but that's homosexual intercourse. The actual act carries a death penalty. That'll solve the problem. We won't be endlessly debating about whether or not God did this, that, or another thing, you know, and needs to be corrected. We simply recognize this is the penalty God prescribed. How they got there doesn't matter. We're not questioning in a court of law whether we should let them escape the death penalty, because we're here to decide whether or not their behavior is excusable. God said it's not. So it doesn't matter what excuses you might come up with. This is the fact. 21. Marrying a woman and her mother. 22. Having sexual intercourse with an animal. 23. The harlotress daughter of a priest. Number 24, girls who are discovered not to have been a virgin when they married. Number 20, so which is of course just saying premarital sex carries what? A death penalty, pure and simple. 25, fornication with a betrothed girl. 26, rape of a betrothed girl. 27, anybody who is not a priest getting too close or attempting to touch any of the tabernacle equipment. 28. A negligent accessory to a homicide. Sounds like I went to Harvard's law school, because that's not what, you know, how the Bible describes it. Can anybody remember this number 28, Exodus 21, what happened? Of course you can. But, you know, talk about a paraphrase. If you have an ox that has been known to gore, and that ox has escaped you, and it kills somebody, then what dies? You do, and the ox. So I came up with negligent homicide, but it's descriptive there about how it is. You knew the animal was dangerous. It had done this before. You didn't properly restrain it. You die for what you've done here. You're going to respect life. Excuse me. 29 is false witness in a capital offense case. So if you are called to testify, the offense would carry a death penalty. You testify falsely, then you also will be put to death as a false witness in a capital case. Now, the last one, I think it would have us just turn and look, because it is such a hugely important, toweringly interesting topic in our own culture these days. Come to Exodus chapter 21. And we'll just read this. We're only studying Leviticus, of course, and coming up on Deuteronomy, but let's break for a minute and get back into Exodus 21. All right, this was my number 30, and I'm entitled it, Causing Injury to an Unborn Child. In Exodus chapter 21, we're going to read verses 22 through 25. If men struggle with each other, well, that's what brought all this up in Leviticus 24. Two guys fighting, one of them swore, here we go again. Guys do this, doesn't make it right, but they do. And if men struggle with each other, and strike a woman with child. Well, somehow in the melee, a pregnant woman gets involved. She has a miscarriage. So somehow she's knocked to the ground. Whatever happens, the injury she sustains in the fight creates a miscarriage. Yet, there is no injury. Now, people debate and argue about this, but I think it's pretty plain that the injury we're talking about is not to the woman, it's to the child. He shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. So you get carte blanche to set, you know, the fine. You caused a miscarriage, but the kid's okay. Still, you're going to pay a fine. He shall pay as the judges decide. So he gets to demand whatever he wants, but we're going to have a trial, and the judges are going to have to decide whether or not it's reasonable. 23. But if there is injury, then you shall appoint life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Now, you've just noticed there's your argument for, well, we're not talking about the baby. There's no burning, you know, the baby. And so this must be only on the woman. If you look at the bottom of the chart that I handed out, though, you'll find that in this location in Exodus, but I'm going to quote at the bottom of the page from Leviticus 24. I think you'll find that what happened here was, while he is speaking of a particular kind of a thing that would be, frankly, rather rare, also how many pregnant women get involved in fisticuffs, you know, and then have a miscarriage. So it'd be really rare. But it is occasioned now to give us a general principle. So in three places, actually, you're going to have this eye for an eye statement. I have at the bottom of your chart, Leviticus 24, the chapter we're studying, verses 17 through 22. If a man takes the life of any human being, when a woman is pregnant, what is she pregnant with? It's a human being. If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. The one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good, life for life. Well, now the man doesn't die, but he needs to replace the animal. He's going to have to buy the guy a replacement. 19. If a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as the native, for I am the Lord your God. So when people come in to be a part of this group, they need to be informed about the laws. But this, you know, is more inclusive, perhaps, than the actual case in Exodus 21, which is our only case. So you have to go back to Exodus 21 if you're going to take up the great question, you know, about abortion in our time. Now, abortion's been around for an awful long time, all throughout the ages, various forms and ways, you know, that this has been done. But it is always a mortal evil. What happens is a human being at some stage of its gestation is killed. That's murder. That's the only thing it can be. All the tremendous amount of argumentation in, you know, the Supreme Court and everything back in 1975 and all the rest of that does not change the fact. Women are not pregnant with rocks. They're not pregnant with vegetables. They're not pregnant with spirit beings. They are pregnant with human beings. It is a human thing at some stage of development. Life for life, foot for foot, fracture for fracture, etc., fleshes out then this rule of jurisprudence begins in the womb in Exodus 21 and then carries on throughout all of your life. So I think what's happening in Exodus 21, you know, is a particular case, if you will, and then, you know, the way it's stated embraces both the child as well as the mother and then anybody else in every other circumstance, as Leviticus 24 makes plain. Bill.
Exodus 21:22. Can you read what your Bible says?
A New American Standard in Exodus 21 and in verse 22, he said. Exodus 21 in verse 22 says, if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further, is added, injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. I have a footnote that says, with the expression miscarriage, an untimely birth.
Okay, and I've got the American Standard, and it says if her fruit depart, and to me that sounds like it dies.
No, I think it's depart the womb. And then you have this list of penalties. What happens? There's no injury, so it's premature, but it survives. It had come full term, and so it's an induced birth. That's what that is. But that, it's pretty apparent that that's what we got. So, pressing on back to Leviticus chapter 24. In verse 10, we had this Israelite woman, and she had a son by an Egyptian father. All he did was curse God. And in our culture, how high on the list of terrible things you could do would that get? Why, it'd hardly make the list at all. And, all of the wisdom that opinion writers for USA Today could summon, would suggest that it's just absolutely meaningless. But not in God's mind. One just simply has to choose, you're going to go God's route or not. So, by the time we get to the end of this discussion, at verse 16, the one who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him. So now, after you've had the witnesses lay hands on him, are they the only ones that lift a rock? No. Anybody can do it. When he blasphemes the name, he's going to be put to death. I believe I mentioned this once before, and truly it was a very gruesome thing, but the internet is amazing. And so I have seen an actual stoning. And I really want to go on the record that it was quite surprising to me. I saw a young woman who had been accused of some crime in an African nation surrounded and stoned to death. I watched it happen on the video. When she died, it was so quick, so apparently painless, that I was really shocked. I was kind of steeling myself with all the warnings and everything. It was going to be a long, drawn-out process and all kinds of blood and gore and this kind of thing, And it wasn't that at all. At all. A group of people surrounded her. They each had a stone. Bam! They hit her in the head. These rocks, were good, hefty deals. She just crushed her skull and she just flopped over. Done. It was faster than the electric chair. I was quite surprised. So all the arguments about inhumanity and how much wiser and more virtuous they are compared to God... the fact is, this is a very humane way to quickly and relatively painlessly, for it is certainly not a prolonged or drawn-out thing, to put somebody to death. And for all the times that we've had intravenous drugs and we've had old Sparky go bad for us, and all the rest of that, with this procedure, that's not going to happen. The people are not there to torment. They're not there to torture. They're there to execute. And they took care of it in very short order. It was just near instantaneous. Stop second-guessing God with our standards of morality. So, any question in general there about the case? And I don't guess there is. So now we can go ahead and finish out chapter 24 and get somewhere into 25. Harry. It's not stipulated, and it does not matter. So, see, and I think that's important in all these discussions today, too. It just says there's a miscarriage, and there's consequence. So what is it? Is it a life? Is it an injury? What is it? And so it seems to me, very plain at least, that from the moment of conception, what the woman is carrying is not vegetable, it's not mineral. And it would therefore be categorized as animal, but what animal is that? It's called Homo sapien. It is a human being at whatever stage. I'm talking about the second cell. Okay? So now let's finish it out with starting in verse 17. And if a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. Now, if you can't tell the difference between a judicial proceeding and a murder in that one verse, then, we've built places for people who have that little mental capacity. And I'm sure we can find a hospital somewhere to help you out. They're not the same. So, get used to it. in verse 18, the one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good for the life. If a man injures his neighbor just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he's injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus the one who kills an animal shall make it good. But the one who kills a man shall be put to death. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as the native, for I am the Lord your God. Then Moses spoke to the sons of Israel. They brought the one who had cursed outside the camp, stoned him with stones. Thus the sons of Israel did just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Did I say earlier I didn't know if they did that or not, but they did. Okay. So our test case comes to full fruition. And at the intervening verses, you get a whole lot of information about death penalty and other penalties in general. Okay, with the remaining 10, let's go ahead and run. That was 17 through 23. Okay, so 17 through 23 is your standard of justice. The standard of justice if you're marking there, you're indexing. Okay, so now let's take the first 7 verses. I think we can get, surprisingly, in 10 minutes, pretty deep into chapter 25. We have a Sabbath year. Now, the Sabbath year, chapter 25, and verse 7, reads like this. The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to Yahweh. What does the word Sabbath mean?
Rest.
Does that mean that you're panting and trying to rest in that sense? No. Rest has to do with the cessation of activity. It's like the rest in music. When you come to a rest, it just means you're not supposed to do anything right there. 6 years, verse 3, you shall sow your field. 6 years, you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its crop. But during the 7th year, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to Yahweh. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvests after growth you shall not reap. Your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. And all of you shall have the Sabbath of the land for food. Yourself, your male and female slaves, your hired man, your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you, even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat. Now, this will be explained again later as we get into the next section here, which has to do with the year of Jubilee. But before we get into that, here are these first 7 verses. You have 6 years in which you do all your regular, you know, work to produce the harvest. And then, what do? You take a year off. You know, you don't plow. You don't sow. You don't weed. You don't reap. You spend a whole year. Well, how are they going to live for a whole year if they don't have a crop? He'll tell us as we get going along farther. So I don't really think it needs any, you know, comment on 1 through 7. Sabbaths were very important. Resting was very important. Ceasing from work the way God ceased from his work. The big difference is when God ceased from his work in Genesis, he didn't resume it ever again. He didn't do any more creating. After the 6 days of creation, he ceased, he stopped, he rested. It was over, no more creation. But after the end of the 7th year, what will the people do in the 8th year? Go back to work. They've got to go back to work. Now let's just read on, see how far we can get. But it's verse 8 of chapter 25 through 34. We'll just read the whole thing. But this is your year of Jubilee. And please note that it has nothing whatsoever to do with jubilation. People, you know, in towering ignorance again, Jubilee, well, it must mean we're supposed to be happy. Well, they probably were happy, and I think a lot of people were, you know, and all that, but it's not what the word means. The word in the Hebrew means the trumpet blast. The trumpet blast. Because this year is announced with a trumpet blast. So the Jubilee is the word in Hebrew that means trumpet blast, not rejoicing. Just a common mistake there. Reads like this. You are also to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself. 7 times 7 years. so that you have the time of the seven Sabbaths of years, 49 years. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the seventh month. And then he tells you, what festival is that? That's your Day of Atonement. You shall sound a horn all through your land. So they had horns everywhere. And it was marked on the Day of Atonement. The 49th year just came to an end. The 50th year is starting here on the Day of Atonement. Blow your horn. 10. You shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Not jubilation, but a trumpet blast. And each of you shall return to his own property. Each of you shall return to his family. You shall have the 50th year as a trumpet blast. You shall not sow nor reap its aftergrowth, nor gather in from its untrimmed vines. For it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its crops out of the field. On this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. If you make a sale, moreover, to your friend, or buy from your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Corresponding to the number of years after the Jubilee, after that trumpet blast, after that Day of Atonement, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell to you according to the number of years of crops. In proportion to the extent of the years, you shall increase its price. And in proportion to the fewness of the years, you shall diminish its price. It is a number of crops he is selling to you. So you shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. You shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgments so as to carry them out, so that you may live securely on the land. Then the land will yield its produce so that you can eat your fill and live securely on it. But if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. When you're sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating until the ninth year when its crop comes in. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. Or, in case a man has no kinsman, but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the year since its sale, refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and so return to his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of the trumpet blast. But at the trumpet blast, it shall revert, that he may return to his property. Likewise, if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, then his redemption right remains valid until a full year from its sale. His right of redemption lasts a full year. But if it's not bought back for him within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city passes permanently to its purchaser throughout his generations. It does not revert in the trumpet blast. The houses of the villages, however, which have no surrounding walls, shall be considered as open fields. They have redemption rights and revert in the Jubilee. As for cities of the Levites have a permanent right of redemption for the houses of the cities, which are their possession. What therefore belongs to the Levites may be redeemed, and a house sale in the city of this possession reverts in the trumpet blast. For the houses of the cities of the Levites are their possession among the sons of Israel. But pasture fields of their city shall not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession. Now, in case a countryman of yours becomes poor and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God, that your countrymen may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give to you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Now, time's up. I'm sure the bell will go off at any second. But again, I don't feel the need to go and explicate all of this. You know, we're not practicing it today. Not under that law now, of course. But in a religion that was tied to a specific people in a specific land for a little while, those particular people in that land had these responsibilities. Ultimately, it was a means of keeping everybody in tribal or at least family land ownership. Okay? So, come on back next week, and we'll just have a ton of fun when we take up slavery. Woohoo!